Thanks for listening to this message from the life of St. Bees. We're a church that loves to empower, equip and inspire. And in order to better fulfill this call, we're currently undertaking an audacious church relocation project. Find out more, including how you can take part, at www.goandgrow.london. Thank you, and may this message better help you to live a life full of adventurous faith.
So we're going to have a quick quiz in teacher style. We're going to have a starter quiz. So you're going to have 60 seconds with the people beside you, and you've got five quotes. And these are from films, and you have to guess the film that it's from. And for like extra little bonus points, if you can guess the scene and maybe the character, that is like extra bonus points, okay? So you've got 60 seconds. With the people around you, you can talk, all right. 60 seconds starting now, go. You need to tell me the character, maybe the scene. I should have started watching for 60 seconds. There's a curveball in there. You might have spotted it. Okay, 10 more seconds, quick. All right, and 3, 2, 1. All right. So, I'm going to let you shout out. All right. So, for the first one, to infinity and beyond, who is this guy? Buzz Lightyear. Okay, so we've got Buzz Lightyear. And in terms of the context, when does he normally say this? When do you normally hear him saying this? When he's about to take off on an adventure, when he's about to save the day, when he's about to kind of run off and do something, that's kind of when we see Buzz kind of stepping in and saying his little punchline. Okay, what about this one? Roads. Where we're going, we don't need roads. Back to the Future. Who's the character? Doc Martin. Okay, so he's a mad scientist. And anybody know whereabouts in the film this is taking place? It's right at the end of the first film. So he's kind of setting the scene for the sequel, and they're going off on this big adventure, and that's the anticipation. It's like, where we're going, we don't need roads. Like, where could they possibly be going that they don't need roads? Right, next one. My precious. Gollum, Lord of the Rings. When does he kind of use this line? What's he talking about? What's he doing? He's talking about the ring, okay. So this is an all-consuming, oh, I've just given away the next one. No, I was careful. So Gollum is this character who is all-consumed by this ring. And I mean, to the extent that his own personal like health and everything else goes with it, like this, the ring is the center of his life and it is precious to him. Okay, the next one. Kip, can you bring my chapstick? But my lips hurt real bad. Napoleon Dynamite. Genuinely, who knew that one? Oh, yes. Okay, great. Yes. This, by the way, if you have not seen this film, it is hilarious. It is so good. So they're like these rival, they're brothers. They've got this weird like rivalry, and they're just so funny, and they just give each other crap all the time, and it's just so good. And the last one, of course, just keep swimming. Dory from Finding Nemo, of course. And what is happening at this part in the film when she's talking about this? They've got lost, and they've also lost their biggest clue. They're trying to find Nemo, they've lost the biggest clue, and Marlin has just completely given up. And Dory's like, just keep swimming. Like, we can do this. It's an encouragement. Like, come on. So if you knew those lines, you probably knew the character who said it. You probably knew the story beforehand, you probably knew the story afterwards, and yeah, you could think about what was going on at the time. Where if you didn't know it, it was just meant nothing to you, you had no idea. So from that, for example, if you were having a tough time at work, or maybe you were having a tough time reaching a personal goal, or just you were just having a rough time in general, if I said to you, just keep swimming, hopefully you would know that I wasn't telling you to go for an actual swim, that it was a reference to that, like, you can do it, just keep going, it's an encouragement type of thing. But yeah, if you haven't seen Finding Nemo, you're going to think I'm telling you to go for a swim and be like, I'm not sure that's going to help, but thanks anyway. All right. So it's all about context. So I'm going to cover two bits of context, because when we read the Bible, you need to think about the context of what you're reading, who was writing it, when was it written, what was going on at the time. So we are going to think about the context, and I'm going to cover two bits kind of briefly. And the main reason why we need to do this is because if you don't do this, there is kind of one or two things that can happen. The first is that you read it, and you have no idea what's going on. You're just like, I have no idea why the author even bothered to write that down. I'm not sure why it's relevant. Move on. The second is arguably the more dangerous of the two, is that you misinterpret it entirely and come up with a brand new scenario. So not only have you missed what the author wanted you to get from it, but you might have come up with some dangerous new meaning that is not at all what the Bible was trying to tell you. So our two bits. The first one. This whole series, by the way, if you've been about for the last few weeks, is about encounters that Jesus had in the Gospels. And I decided to look at Jesus and the Pharisees. And we're going to look at this from the Pharisees' perspective. If you've been around church, you'll probably know the word Pharisee. It's been thrown about quite a bit, and usually like not in a positive light most of the time. Like, you might know that. But I want to make sure, before we look at our text, that we know exactly who they were, what they meant to the Jewish community, and what they were about. So I got some headlines to kind of bring us up to speed with that. So the first bit about our Pharisees is that they were a religious sect. There were a couple of religious sects around at the time. They were fairly well educated, and they were fairly middle class. So they weren't quite like lower working class. They were educated, middle class, and one of the religious sects at the time. You would have found them mostly in the synagogues. So if you were kind of thinking about where you would find them in the community, mostly in the synagogues. They were, out of all the religious sects, arguably, obsessed with the law. They were amazing teachers of the law. They knew it back to front, inside out. They memorized entire books, if not the first five books entirely. And not only were they amazing at knowing the law inside out, but they also believed that they could interpret the law. So imagine you have scenario A, and there's nothing in the law that talks about this scenario. Well, they come up with the oral law. So they took the principles and could come up with laws around this new scenario so that if it ever happened again, they were like, we've got the oral law about this as well. So they knew the oral law as well as the written law, and they were obsessed about it. And it kind of, in a good way, I suppose, that was their intention, I suppose. Although they get a bad rep, this was the kind of thing that I was quite surprised about, that they really thought the covenant of God was for ordinary people. They really wanted to include everybody in that covenant. So as long as you kept your purity, your kosher, your Sabbath, your prayer, your tithing, they believed that that was accessible to all people. Now, obviously, that was a fairly high bar, but it wasn't hierarchical in a way. That's what I understand of it. I could be wrong, but that's what I understood from it anyway. And the lastly, which I thought was interesting, considering where we're going to end up, they were the moral center for the Jewish community. They were the voice of reason. So if you had a bit that you were like, I'm not really sure what the law says about this, or, I mean, should we do this? Should we do that? Like, what does the law say? You would go to the Pharisees and be like, what is your kind of take on it? They were the voice of reason. They were the moral center for the Jewish people. So that's our first bit of context. Our Pharisees, that's who we're dealing with today. Now, our second bit of context is where we are in the book of Matthew. So the bit that we're looking at later is in chapter 23, but it's good to kind of get an idea of where we are in the story and what's happening here. So we're going to watch a little clip in just a second, but this is from the Bible Project on YouTube. If you have not heard about this or have never watched it, it is epic. It is so good. They summarize entire books of the Bible in a really accessible way, and it's really changed how I read the Bible as well. So if you haven't, little side note, go to YouTube, look in the Bible Project. It's great. So I think we're going to play that. Is that good to go? Cool.
The Gospel according to Matthew. In the first video, we saw how Matthew introduced Jesus as the Messiah from the line of David and as a new authoritative teacher like Moses, and also as Emmanuel, which in Hebrew means God with us. After Jesus announced and taught about the arrival of God's kingdom, and after he brought the kingdom into day-to-day life among the people of Israel, we saw that Jesus was accepted by many, but rejected by others, especially Israel's religious leaders, the Pharisees. And so the big question is, how is this conflict between Jesus and Israel's leaders going to play itself out? The next large section, chapters 14 through 20, explore all the different expectations people have about the Messiah. So Jesus keeps healing sick people, and twice he even miraculously provides food for these huge crowds in the desert. One's made up of Jewish people, and the other is a non-Jewish crowd. And this sign, it's very similar to what Moses did for Israel in the wilderness. And so all these people are excited about Jesus. They think he's the great prophet and the Messiah, but not the religious leaders. Their view of the Messiah is built on passages like Psalm 2 or Daniel chapter 2 about a victorious Messiah who's going to deliver Israel and defeat the pagan oppressors. And from their point of view, Jesus, he's a false teacher. He's making blasphemous claims about himself. And so there are stories here about them increasing their opposition, hatching a plan to kill him.
Okay, cool. Thank you. All right. So just to kind of quickly summarize, the three main things that the author really wanted to point out to you there. The first was Jesus was the Messiah, okay? Now, that was leading up to, if you read the Old Testament, and we don't have time to go through the whole thing, but the whole point of the Old Testament is that they needed this Messiah to restore blessing to the Israelites and also restore blessing to the world. So this Messiah character was really important for restoring this blessing. And the author of Matthew wants you to know that it's Jesus. The second thing is that Jesus is like a new Moses. He is an authoritative figure in the law. He knows what he's talking about. And the third thing is that Jesus is not just another prophet. He's not just this some messenger sent down to kind of try and do a good job. He is God with us. It is God himself come to rescue us, to do the Messiah restoring of blessings, that thing. So where we're at in the story is that Jesus has announced God's kingdom. He has been bringing the kingdom into people's lives, so healing, signs, wonders, and there has been a real mixed bag of reactions to Jesus. Some people love him, think he's amazing, cannot get enough of him, and some people just really are not keen and think that he is not good news. And this side is mainly the Pharisees. They are not impressed. And the last little bit that we get to is that there's this big conversation about who the Messiah should be. Who is this guy? What should he be? And the Pharisees are saying, well, listen, he should be coming in on a horse with a big sword and taking down the Roman Empire, and he should restore us, and that's his job. Whereas Jesus is a bit like, oh, well, I'd actually planned to be the suffering servant and sacrifice myself to save everyone. And they're just not impressed. They're like, no, that's not who we signed up for. No. So where we land, where we're going to kind of dive in, is right at the peak of this tension between Jesus and the Pharisees. They're having this battle of words, this war in law, and they've already plotted to kill Jesus at this point. They've already tried to corner him with questions about the law and trick him into saying certain things, and all that's really happened is that Jesus has actually made them look dumb. Like, that's what's happened. He's kind of managed to outsmart them, and the tension is high. So where we step in is a real high tension part. So we're going to read Matthew 23. It's a bit of a long passage, but it's worth it. Matthew 23, 13 to 36. And at this point, Jesus is with a crowd of people, and there are some Pharisees there as well. So it's not like this is one-on-one thing. There's actually a bit of a crowd as well. So I'll give you a minute to find that if you want to read along. I've got it up on the screen, and lovely Emma is going to read it for us as well.
So it can be found on page 938, starting at verse 13. Woe to you, teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in the people's faces. You yourself do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and then you make that convert twice as much a child of hell as you are. Woe to you, blind guides! You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple is bound by the oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But whoever swears by the gift on the altar is bound by the oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, anyone who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And anyone who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And anyone who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. Woe to you, teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. You blind guides, you strain out of a gnat but swallow a camel. Woe to you, teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you hypocrites. You clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisees, first clean the inside of the cup and the dish, and then the outside also will be clean. Woe to you, hypocrites of the law, and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous. And you say, if we had lived in the days of our ancestors, we would not have taken part with them in the shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourself that you are the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of sin of your ancestors. You snakes, you brood of vipers, how will you escape being condemned to hell? Therefore, I am sending you prophets and sages and teachers. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. And so upon you will come all of the righteous blood that has been shed on the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I tell you, all this will come upon this generation.
Thank you. So, oh man, there's so many parts in this where I just cringe. I'm just like, oh my word, like he's just not hesitating in any way. And there's parts of the Bible where you read it and you're like, I wonder what Jesus means. And then you read this and you're like, I'm hearing exactly what Jesus means. And there's also parts where he says his insult and then explains it, like just in case they didn't get the message. Like, I kind of love it. And if you've ever had the image that Jesus is soft and mild and, you know, warm and cuddly, let this really change your mind. Like, he tears them to shreds. Like, he's done tiptoeing around them. So, he doesn't exactly mince his words. I mean, no ambiguity. He was annoyed. He was frustrated. He was seething. Like, just absolutely furious at these Pharisees. And I think what he was more furious at was just they had got so religious. Like, it was mentioned a few times during the prayers and even a part, I think, in some of the songs that we were singing earlier, that they had just become so much about the religion that they had forgot the point of a lot of it. And he was like, you do one thing and you say another, like, what is the point? And he just gives one example after another about how they contradict themselves, like, time and time again. He calls them hypocrites, you blind fools. Like, he just does not even hold back. He's holding no punches. And as if he hadn't let it on thick enough, he then proceeded to call them a brood of vipers or a pack of snakes. And I think it's worth pointing out that serpents and snakes in the Bible were an image. They were commonly used throughout the Bible as an image. And it was used as an image to a group of people, to a character, to a person who was in direct opposition to God. So think like snake in the Garden of Eden, think serpent in Revelation who's having that big fight. It's seen as a person or a group of people who are in direct opposition to God. And Jesus here is saying to the Pharisees, you are opposing God and his kingdom. And they're like, what? You're calling me in league with the devil. Like, it is outrageous. It's just madness that he would even say this to them. But that tells you the level of anger, and it's just how furious Jesus actually is here. Now, there are lots of things that we could look into here, but we are looking at this from the Pharisee's perspective. And to be honest, as a Pharisee, I can only imagine one of two ways that you could take this roasting from Jesus. There's really only one of two ways that I could see it. Was it like a sudden awareness of how far they'd strayed? They saw the error of their ways, and deep down they knew the truth of what Jesus was speaking. You were like, do you know what, actually, you're spot on. Like, you're totally right. We've just got so far off track. Or was there just a deep, deep fury at possibly the biggest insult they've probably ever heard? I mean, who was this Jesus anyway? Like some rogue rabbi who didn't even keep the Sabbath. I mean, constantly challenging and breaking the laws. I mean, we're the Pharisees. We're the good guys. We're following the law. It's in the Bible. It's in Scripture. We're doing it. He's just challenging our authority and making us look stupid in front of everybody. Plus, he has much said that we were in league with the devil. We're a group of people who have devoted our lives to disciplining ourselves, denying ourselves, memorizing these scriptures, teaching the people, all for the sake of keeping God's covenant. Definitely for the sake of keeping God's covenant. Or was it for the sake of pride and keeping up appearances, or maintaining a higher social status than the synagogue down the road? Was it to maintain that element of power and authority within the community? Had those undercurrents perhaps become a little bit stronger than their love for God's people? I'd love to think that after Jesus' war of words, they come out sobered and seeing the error of their ways. But in reality, we read in Matthew 26 that they just plotted to secretly arrest him and kill him. They actually teamed up with the Sadducees, who they famously didn't get on with. That like says how determined they were. This law that they were so devoted to was designed to show God's character. It was designed to show God's character to the nations around Israel. It was a set of guidelines to a lifestyle that brought justice and showed mercy, and it showed love to neighbors and compassion to widows and orphans. And it brought peace among the different cultures that were in the area. Well, that's what it was designed to do. It showed you how to honor God and how to make yourself clean again when you needed to. But the Pharisees were more devoted to knowing the rules about love and peace, so much so that they forgot to practice love and bring the peace. They were more interested in the rules about the love and peace that they didn't bring love or show love or bring peace. And the ultimate, it's almost funny if it wasn't so ridiculous, but they were so passionate about keeping this law that they were willing to murder someone. Like the law that says don't murder, they were like, we need to protect it, murder that guy. Like it makes no sense. And this isn't what I'm going to focus on, but it just was a passing thought as I was going through it. But the Pharisees thought they were the good guys. Like they were like, we're following the laws, we're doing everything it says. Like he's the one breaking the Sabbath. And how many times have we said, and like, I mean, as we as humanity, not necessarily we as in St. B's just, but like we as humanity, have we said, like, look, it's in the Bible. I'm the good guy here. I'm doing what the Bible says. Like, how many of those times is Jesus actually asking us to just put the legalism, put the religion down for a second, and just love that person where they're at? Like, stop comparing yourself to them. Stop thinking about the religion behind it. Actually, how about we just love that person first and see how we go? And we see it all the time, all around the world. I think it was actually again mentioned in the prayers that people are doing horrendous things in the name of God because it's in the Bible or because it's in their holy book. And it's just something to think about, but it's not what we're going to focus on. So back to our devoted Pharisees. Again, almost funny if it wasn't devastating, was they were so devoted to this law and this covenant that they were really trying to fiercely protect that they didn't even recognize God when he arrived. Like, really? And I heard a person wiser than me describe it like this. They were so focused on the cake stand that they didn't see the cake. And I think I meant, yeah. They were so focused on the cake stand that they didn't see the cake. I mean, the cake's the good bit. The cake stand just looks pretty, but the cake's the good bit. That's the bit that you want. So what can we learn from this, from looking at this? I mean, in a nutshell, I guess it's don't be a hypocrite, isn't it? Like, but I think what it boils down to for me is two things, and that's heart and integrity. The Pharisees were deeply religious. They didn't have a heart and integrity for what they were doing. And the word hypocrite originates from a word that basically implies that you're wearing a mask. And you can see this with the Pharisees. You know, they said one thing and they did another. They had their public, I'm a Pharisee face, and then they had their real face. They were all show and no substance. And actually, there's a part, you know, when he talks about, there's the Pharisees had these little boxes, I can't remember the name of them, but the little boxes they put on their right hand and on their foreheads, and they held the law inside the little boxes to remind them that everything you think about and everything you do should be revolved around the law. But they used to make these boxes, like, ridiculously big to show off that they were keeping the law, you know, and it's like, that wasn't the point. You know, it's not for other people, it's for God. And even the tassels that they had on the clothing that they used to wear got, like, ridiculously long to kind of just be, like, to make sure that people noticed, like, I'm a Pharisee, I'm following the law, I'm doing what I'm supposed to. So they were all show and no substance. You could rephrase that as they were all religion and no faith. And someone that has come from a very religious background, to me, there's a massive difference from religion and faith. Huge. Growing up from a religious background, there's rules. You do this because I said so. Whereas actually having an active, like, interactive relationship with God is much more fulfilling than rules and regulations. And don't mishear me. I'm not saying that the rules were completely uncalled for, but that's a whole other sermon that is not my job. I'm not doing that bit. So it got me thinking, do I have a Sunday face and then a rest of the week face? And if I do have a Sunday face, do I have this Sunday face because I think I'm afraid of what people would think if they see my real face? Like, oh, I'll put this face on just in case they don't like what they actually see. Or do I have one because I want to maintain the image that I'm this super mighty woman of God who's got it all together? And like, what would people think if they knew that this happened to me or that I decided to do this? What would happen? Like, take that, like, package that, and add it to the fear of losing your position of power or the unhealthy peer pressure of the other perfect people or the other perfect Pharisees down the road. And I can see how a Pharisee quickly developed his Pharisee face. Jesus says earlier in Matthew that in his kingdom you are better to come from a place of humility. Those that are humbled are exalted. When you humble yourself, you're exalted in God's kingdom. It's the upside down kingdom that he talks about a lot in Matthew. And to me personally, that means to be transparent, to be open, to be vulnerable when it comes to your faith and how you live. To come from the heart and have integrity with your faith and not just do the things that people think that you should be doing, not just going through the motions. And the best way I can illustrate this is actually with an example from some bees a while ago that really had a big impact on me actually. And if you come to this church regularly, you probably know this already, but regularly from the front of this church, I hear our leaders talk about things that they struggle with, that things they find challenging. They talk about their own personal struggles, whether it comes to God's timing or trust or just issues that they have. And it's so refreshing. It's great. It's really good. And there was one time in particular, I remember a leader standing at the front of this church, and they're just very openly telling people about their struggle with money and debt. And I remember just being completely baffled and astounded that this person would just very vulnerably and bravely tell the whole congregation about that issue that they had. And I was impressed at the time, but it also had this amazing side effect that, I thought, if they can stand up there and have issues and just be vulnerable and open and tell people about it, then I'm allowed to have issues as well. I don't have to keep my Sunday face up. If they have issues and they can talk about it, so can I. And they're a religious leader, and I'm not. So it gave me permission to have issues and be open about them as well. So, leading by example. Something I've been trying to be really honest about that's been bugging me for probably about the last 6 months or so It's doubt. Now, not doubt that God is real, or that God loves me, or that God's for this planet and everybody on it. It's not that. I totally, like, I'd be lost without God, and I know that he loves me to bits. But when I think about his plan to bring the kingdom, like his kingdom to earth, I'm just like, you want to use us to do that? Like, have you met us? Like, we are famously unreliable, and we screw up a lot. Like, are you sure? And I think my hope just starts to waver a little when I realize that he wants to include us in those plans. And that's when I'm kind of like, oof, that I don't know if I can trust that, because I just know how unreliable we are. And maybe it's a cynic in me. It could be. But that's what I've been wrestling with at the minute. I'm just like trying to just figure out, and I can't really see the woods for the trees. And I know that I'm talking to people about it. People who know me well know this already. But I know the answer will most reveal itself when I lean in. And I worry that sometimes it's just much easier to lean back. It's just like, oh, do you know what? That's really hard to deal with. I'm just not sure I can go there. It's actually much harder to lean in. And there was, I can't even remember what it was called, but there was a religious leaders group that met up about a year and a half ago now, and they talk about Moses' journey and how if God had said to Moses at the beginning, this is going to be horrendous, you're not going to want to be here throughout all of it. He didn't say that to Moses, though. He said, this is what I want you to do, go do it. And Moses did. And at the points of the journey where the Israelites are doing Moses' head in, he leans in. He doesn't lean out, and I keep remembering that. It might be easier to lean out, but it's better to lean in. So, now it's your turn. I'm not going to ask you to make a cue at the mic, don't worry. But do you have something burning, like sitting on your chest, where you're just like, oh my goodness, the people knew that. Oh my word, I would never tell anybody that. Like, you can't say that sort of stuff at church. There's no way. Like, I have to keep my Sunday face on when I'm here. If people knew what I really, like, felt about that topic or whatever it is. Well, I actually think you can. I think that church is where that takes place. And one thing that the Pharisees, I think they made a big mistake because they picked pride over humility. But I also think they forgot about God's love and his mercy and his kindness and how he doesn't sit and judge you with a wagging finger. He doesn't do that. And Jesus knows we're not perfect. He's not expecting you to create this perfect Sunday mask. To me, what I've always loved about church is that this is a safe place where we can all come, we can bring our baggage, and we can show our face. We don't need to bring the masks with us. That's for me, that's what I aim for. So just as I kind of finish up, I'm going to invite the band to come back up. But just a few things to kind of leave you with that I kind of was mulling over is that when we admit to our faults and our weaknesses, it gives other people permission to not be perfect as well. It kind of allows them to be like, okay, they messed up, so can I. Okay, it's good. And I was thinking about this last night. I was driving back, and I don't know if any of you know the band The Killers. I was listening to a really old album of theirs. And there was two lines from this song that kind of came on, and I was like, oh my goodness, that was perfectly timed. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. And really what I'm trying to get at is it's not about having two faces. It's about trying to have integrity and come from the heart, like mean what you're doing and not be religious, not go through the motions and forgetting why you're doing things. And the lyrics went, they said, save some face, you know you've only got one. Change your ways while you're young. Now, I don't think that means like physically when you're young. If you're older, you can do this too. And the last thing it said was smile like you mean it. Don't do a fake smile. Don't have your Pharisee face. Smile like you mean it. Smile like you want to be there and you want to take part. All right. I think we're just going to take a little bit of time to think. You might be really happy with where you're at, or you might be like, actually, if you're anything like me, you might have a bit of a Sunday face. And I just want you to have a little moment to chat with God about that, to think about that, and see where that takes you in the next little moment of worship.